This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the fourth week of March, and this week brought the focus on making sure hospitals are as ready as possible for the surge of cases headed to them. With nearly 40,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and more than 400 deaths as of Friday, New York is the epicenter of America's outbreak. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's daily press conferences have been getting national attention, as he explains how the state is converting convention centers and arenas into makeshift hospitals, figuring out how to put two patients on one ventilator, and trying to rapidly scale up a hospital system that normally has about 56,000 beds so it can house 140,000 patients if it comes to that. Nationally, the question is whether it will come to that, but at some hospitals in New York City, it already has. And the American county with the highest death rate from coronavirus so far isn't even in New York. It's Orleans Parish, which contains the city of New Orleans. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb says besides the obvious focuses of New York and Seattle, he's worried about New Orleans, Detroit, Miami, Chicago, Los Angeles. Add enough cities, and eventually you're pretty much talking about a map of the whole country. So what's our prognosis? To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Christine Emba of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having us.
And we're also joined this week by Aaron Carroll. Aaron is a professor of pediatrics and a researcher at the Indiana University School of Medicine. He also writes about health policy for the New York Times and other publications. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
Doing all right, considering. Can you give us the national picture? Where are we in this outbreak, and when is it going to peak?
So, unfortunately, we're still very, very early, and it's not going to peak probably for some time. I shouldn't say most of the country, but a lot of the country is still not engaging in the social distancing that we would like. And even those that are have only recently started to do so. Most of the infections that'll show up in the next 2 weeks are already baked into the cake. They've already happened. And beyond that, there'll still be family spread in households where people might be infecting each other. We're still worried about healthcare workers getting sick, and most projections have us still on an increasing path for at least weeks, and it could be longer, and it will be some time until we get over the crest and then start to feel comfortable that maybe we're starting to suppress this.
So one of the key features this week has been this debate essentially about how bad it's going to get in the hospitals. And so Dr. Deborah Birx, who's the coronavirus response coordinator, she made some remarks on Thursday at the White House about the size of the outbreak, saying essentially that these models that entail 20% or more of the population getting infected, that we're not seeing that outcome reflected on the ground in countries like South Korea or even Italy. And so some of these models about hospitals becoming totally overwhelmed, she thinks it's premature to be sending public signals that that's likely to happen. Now, obviously, this relates closely to the question of how many ventilators you need, which we'll talk about in the moment. But is Dr. Birx right about this? Because I find when I try to look at forecasts from epidemiologists, they're all over the map. 538's been monitoring forecasts from dozens of epidemiologists, and they vary widely. And so it's been really difficult for me as a layperson to figure out how to evaluate this debate. And because the projections vary so widely, they obviously vary in how alarming they are.
So, of course, any good analysis or any good model is going to have a range of outcomes from, you know, this is what we think is the worst case scenario, this is what we think is the best case scenario, and this is what we think is the most likely. That Imperial College report that came out, the thing that everybody grasped onto was the worst case scenario, where we do nothing. We just let this thing run rampant through a country, and this is what's going to happen in England, and this is what's going to happen in the United States. The good news is we're not doing nothing. And so when you even saw some of the reports yesterday that the people who did the model for Imperial College were now hedging, some of that hedging was them saying, look, we're engaging in serious social distancing. We think that that will be better. What didn't change is the long-term projection of sort of how many people they thought might overall get infected over time and how many people might therefore be seriously ill and perhaps die over time. They were just saying, we feel more comfortable now in England that we might not completely overwhelm the healthcare system, because if we engage in the social distancing, we will flatten the curve enough that too many people won't get sick at the same time. That, of course, is all predicated on the idea that we engage in massive social distancing. Why didn't these things happen in China and in South Korea? Well, first of all, in China, it's important to remember they built an enormous amount of infrastructure. I mean, we all watched that hospital go up in like 7 days, you know, by satellite. They did fear they'd overwhelm the healthcare system. And they were also engaging in levels of isolation and social distancing that we're not even contemplating in the United States, you know, removing people from homes if they get infected so that they cannot even have in-house or in-family infectivity. No one's talking about that in the United States. So it's very early to get optimistic about things might go really well, especially since the countries that more closely resemble to us and what we are doing in Europe are not showing people really getting a handle on this or getting on top of it. Italy, Spain, other countries are seriously getting overwhelmed, and that's where we could be headed in the United States, much more likely than a Singapore, a South Korea, or a China.
Rich, what do you make of the public conversation that's been happening around this? I feel like there's almost, to Aaron's point, been some victory laps around this, you know, the new projections from these Imperial College forecasters in the United Kingdom. But it's, you know, it seems like everyone should have expected that the outcomes would be dependent on what sort of social distancing measures that we took. And it seems super early to be feeling like, hey, this was overstated.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people misunderstood that study. As Aaron pointed out, there was always a range of outcomes that the high end based if you did nothing, the lower end if you actually instituted a lockdown, which the UK is now doing. I do think that people who want to minimize the virus and illness, though, have fastened on the fact that some people have been pointing to those bigger numbers without the necessary nuance. So then they feel vindicated when the author or one of the authors of the study comes back and says, no, actually, we're not going to have that bigger number. I welcome the debate over how serious this virus is. I think it's foolish to try to squelch it. You know, you've had Medium posts taken down and Twitter suppressing tweets they don't like. But we should have this debate. I'm more on the alarmist side. But it's still, you know, fairly unknown virus. There's a big public policy question about how to respond to it. Certainly downsides to a lockdown, you know, which we've seen in the enormous unemployment claim numbers. So there's a certain fanaticism around the folks who are most alarmist about this, who, you know, might be very well right about the public policy that I think is unhealthy.
What do you make of that, Christine? Is the marketplace of ideas serving us well here?
The marketplace of ideas has become extremely broad, which is good for individuals and organizations who feel like their voices aren't being heard. But in a time of crisis, certain voices are not being heard and shouldn't be heard because they are uninformed and are telling people things that could lead to harm. So, Rich, you mentioned that Twitter is taking down tweets that they don't like. I'm wondering if you were referring to the tweet by the Federalist that Twitter took down, in which a writer who identified himself as a physician, who was not, in fact, a physician, he was not licensed anymore, wrote a piece and shared it about how Americans should actually start having at-home coronavirus parties, like measles parties, to encourage herd immunity. This is a terrible idea. Skepticism, you know, may be fine, but putting forward bad information, false information that could end up killing people is not acceptable at this time. Yes, we should be having conversations about what the real numbers are, how cautious we really need to be. But at the baseline, this is a crisis. And throwing up our hands and hemming and hawing about how we can sort of sneakily go outside and what the best way to do that is not actually helpful in this moment. And I'm not sure that I would encourage it. The marketplace of ideas is great, and I love it. But sometimes some of these ideas are harmful. And I'm okay with the fact that harmful ideas are not being given the respect that perhaps some people think they deserve.
Rich, do you want to respond to that? I mean, I think the Medium post that you're referring to was from a Silicon Valley guy who's basically was like, well, I know about making things go viral in technology. Let me apply my statistical understanding of that to the virus. And it seems to me like he made a number of serious mistakes in his analysis. And yet, you know, it was being widely shared by conservative media figures basically to argue that the panic was excessive here. It seems like a lot of people have appointed themselves experts in an irresponsible way here.
Well, I mean, that's a symptom of a free society. And let me give you another example. We'd heard for weeks that masks don't do any good and people shouldn't wear a mask. And that was sort of the expert consensus. And so should we have suppressed any dissents from that view? And then all of a sudden, the expert view, or a lot of it, just turned around and said, yeah, you know, when we go to the post-lockdown world, everyone should wear masks. So I think debate, even if it involves terrible ideas, even if it involves dissent that people don't like, is a healthy thing. And I'm not saying any of these people are right about in their particular analysis here or in their take of the virus. Obviously, we shouldn't have, you know, chickenpox parties. But one of the lessons I've taken from various debates in international life over the last 20 years, this would have been the view. There are a lot of people who said Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction at the outset of the war. And that seemed crazy, absolutely crazy. It was the crankiest, most extreme people who said that. And they are right. And it would have been a bad idea to suppress them. It's a bad idea to suppress terrible arguments now. Just defeat them in the field of ideas. No one's going to die if you have to do that.
I would say, actually, people really are going to die. That's the problem.
I think that there's a difference in sort of what, you know, when we talk about the range of ideas and that we should have a debate, first of all, I think that that is fine, but it's also important to recognize what are the implications of you know, being wrong. And in some of these cases, especially when we talk about the masks, like, look, people have been debating the value of masks for some time. I think most of us have been pretty consistent that there's not a lot of evidence that for healthy people, they do a ton to prevent you from getting sick if you go out into the world. They're massively helpful. If you are a, you know, a healthcare provider and someone could sneeze into your mouth, then yes, that would be a great place. And there's probably some, you know, significant use that if you are sick and it prevents you from coughing or sneezing to somewhere else. I think you're seeing some debate now about for this specific virus, whether there's use, because it's turning out that a bunch of people are asymptomatic and we just don't know. So now if a lot of people are not known sick, but perhaps could be expelling virus, then there is, yes, the rules have changed, or the data have changed. We should reevaluate whether or not they are good or not. But given that there's such a severe shortage of some of these things, and there are people where the value is desperately needed in terms of healthcare workers, still have been careful and cautious all the way along. I still think that we've gone the right way. Doesn't mean we shouldn't reevaluate, but I think people have been pretty consistent in general. With respect to having, you know, chickenpox parties, that is a different thing with a big outcome. And if that becomes, if people are really doing that, it totally invalidates all the social distancing we're doing and makes a lot of that. And the problem also is that a number of experts see the coming storm of overwhelming hospitals and facilities. And that, unfortunately, we have to take action to prevent weeks in advance, if not months in advance. If every time we get lax, the clock starts over, and we can't just change that on a dime. And so I do get concerned when there's a debate and the idea that, like, no one really knows if we should be social distancing or not, because that's the only tool we've got in the toolbox. That's what pretty much every other country is doing. It's sort of the recognized way to flatten the curve. And if we don't engage in it, it becomes incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to turn the ship around once the problems have started.
I want to talk about those efforts to bolster hospital system capacity, the questions of whether we have enough of various kinds of equipment. The president was making some comments about this on Thursday in an interview on Fox News with Sean Hannity. Here's some sound.
I don't believe you need 40,000 or 30,000 ventilators. You know, you go into major hospitals sometimes, they'll have two ventilators. And now all of a sudden they're saying, can we order 30,000 ventilators? So, look, it's a very bad situation. We haven't seen anything like it. But the end result is we got to get back to work. And I think we can start by opening up certain parts of the country, you know, Farm Belt, certain parts of the Midwest, other places.
Yeah. So, Rich, what do you make of that, watching from the New York area? As you know, you've seen Governor Cuomo saying that they need this number of ventilators because there's going to be a large number of cases. And when people come into the hospital, they stay on a ventilator for a really long time, much longer than they would for other uses. And there you have the president basically saying, well, you know, I don't really believe these numbers about that there's really this intense need.
Yeah, well, hopefully that's just him not popping off and doesn't reflect what the administration will ultimately do. There's a New York Times story just recently here saying that the administration backed off, or at least has cold feet about a deal with an automaker to make a massive amount of ventilators because they fear the cost, which would be $1 billion, which sounds like a pittance, given the kind of money that Congress is throwing around. And they worry about having a bunch of surplus ventilators at the end of this, which would actually, you know, neither of those are real serious concerns. There shouldn't be obstacles. The story does, though, also say there are legitimate concerns about GM, whether they're overpromised on how quickly they could produce these, and then worries if you put all your eggs into one massive basket, if there's some technical problem or a virus outbreak on the factory line, then you're in trouble and you need to diversify your sources. Those sound like those are legitimate concerns, but just the cost and the number, we shouldn't worry about overspending on this or having more ventilators than we need. And my general attitude is, given that a lockdown is such a serious and radical measure that has such severe downsides, I'm pretty much nothing short of that looks radical to me. Spending $1 billion on ventilators is not radical compared to what we're doing now. You know, having universal testing is not radical compared to what we're doing. Having fever checks in New York, you know, at train stations and other places, is not radical compared to what we're doing. We've sort of, in my view, taken the most radical step you can in huge swaths of the country. And I'd prefer to do almost anything else than what we're doing now, when it's safe to take the pedal off the metal of the lockdowns.
Yeah, Christine, as Rich notes there, we're seeing governors and other local officials pushing on these things in certain parts of the country. But then in other parts of the country, we're seeing a very different response. I mean, the governor of Florida has been resistant to issuing a stay-at-home order. The governor of Mississippi actually overrode various local orders, even though Mississippi's Gulf Coast is quite exposed to the outbreak nearby in New Orleans. And so, you know, as Rich says, you know, some of this stuff may be just the president popping off, but, you know, it seems that he has an, even though he doesn't order these actions directly in most cases, he has a lot of influence, and it concerns me whether that influence is pushing state and local officials and the public in the right directions.
Absolutely. It's incredibly concerning. I mean, first of all, just to address that statement, what is the likelihood that President Donald J. Trump has ever gone to a major hospital, looked at their ventilator supply, and said, I think this is good? That has never happened. He is absolutely, certainly popping off, and as usual, saying complete falsehoods and distracting the populace in order to try and push up his support. In normal times, that's already a bad thing. The president is supposed to be the country's leader. Whether he's right or not, alas, the authority vested in that office means that many people trust and believe what he says. In a moment of crisis where people will live and die, depending on whether health advice and orders are followed, this is even worse. I think that it's going to be, you know, something that we look back on with awe and shame. The number of cities that increasingly tell us, we're overwhelmed, this has happened to us, we didn't prepare, and now terrible things are happening. And yet the city next in line, who we have reports for, the states next in line, the Floridas, the New Orleans, are saying, oh, but it's not going to happen here, we'll be fine. And we're seeing this across the country, and it's extremely disturbing.
Aaron, what do you make of that specific ventilators question? Because obviously the question of precisely how many ventilators you need flows back into those questions about which epidemiological model is right, and how intense the peak of infections and hospitalization cases in any given city is going to be. And so, you know, as Rich describes, that New York Times story, everyone has focused on that, you know, they're concerned about the price tag and how ridiculous is it to be worrying about the price tag. But there is also that issue in there that, you know, how quickly can GM really build ventilators? This is not their core area of expertise. It's been a moving target, how many that they would actually be able to make. And that strikes me as a reasonable concern. You know, if you enter into this contract, are you actually going to get ventilators when you need them? So what is the right approach for officials at all levels of government as they're worrying about there is this acute shortage of ventilators? What do you do in this situation to try to address that?
So first of all, it's important to note that, you know, major hospitals do not have two ventilators. No major hospital has only two ventilators. They have many more ventilators. When we say 30,000, that's what New York State is saying that they need. The national number is going to be significantly higher. I mean, I've seen estimates way up into the hundreds of thousands. So the fact that we're balking at, you know, tens of thousands is a real problem because that's, again, that's just one location. I think Rich brings up a good point. We don't need even like 10, 20, 30,000 ventilators. We're going to need, again, many ventilators potentially, which means we have to be not just going to one car company for a PR win. There needs to be a massive, thought process into how do we get many companies to really build these things, to massively build them as fast as possible, because the need is not years away. It's potentially weeks to months away in places that might need it. You know, if everything was to go off the rails and every was to go, then by midsummer, we could be in the market for, 100 or 200,000 ventilators, if not more. And so it's hard to watch the government keep stutter starting and like saying things will happen soon and then they don't happen, because those of us who have seen projections that are concerning know that there's only a limited amount of time for us to act. And every day we wait will make it even more difficult to get ahead of the potential wave that's coming.
Let's take a break. I'll be back shortly with Rich Lowry of National Review, Christine Emba of The Washington Post, and Aaron Carroll of Indiana University Medical School. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. And Aaron Carroll, professor, pediatrician, and researcher at Indiana University School of Medicine, is also with us. I want to talk about President Trump's expressed desire to get America back open again. I mean, frankly, I think we all want to get America open again. The question is when and how we can do that. I think it's important to note that the president has already been hedging and backing off of his opening up remarks. People who ordinarily realize that the president makes overstatements and promises things sooner than they can actually happen seem not to be applying that analysis here. So the president initially said he wanted to open up the country again after his two-week program to stop the spread. He pushed that back and saying, he would like to get the country open by Easter, but he also couched that. He said, the decision will be based on the data, which is an uncharacteristic thing for him to say. He's also been talking about regions, that maybe there are parts of this country, maybe like part of the Farm Belt, where you can relax restrictions. Ron Klain, who ran the Ebola response for the Obama administration, had an interesting piece in the Washington Post where he said, asking when you can reopen is the wrong question. You need to first ask how you can reopen, what you're going to do besides cessations of interpersonal activity to stop the spread of the virus. Then you figure out when circumstances in the country are going to allow you to implement those new strategies, and that will then tell you where and when you can start taking steps to reopen the country. You don't start with a date. So, Aaron, I guess, what is that strategy for the next phase of this? What do we need to be doing to get to a point where we can talk about reopening certain aspects of the country?
Well, that was actually the focus of the last piece that we wrote for The Atlantic, because I think that's Ron brings up a good point in his op-ed, that we shouldn't be asking when. We're just pulling dates out of the air. It's, what does the world need to look like? What data do we need in order to have a conversation about when to reopen it? So two things need to happen. One, we have to be assured that the social distancing is working. We have to see that we're seeing fewer and fewer, if not very few, new cases appear, new hospitalizations, deaths, because that will mean that we've slowed the spread of the virus significantly. The second thing is what we need to be prepared to do in order to make sure this doesn't happen again. That will require significant, widespread, easy testing, way more than we've got now. And it will require us to be able to test more than just sick people, which is really all we're doing right now. It'll require us to be able to test healthy people, know where this is. We'll also need to be much, much, much more nimble and better at detecting cases, running down their contacts, checking to see if any of them are infected, isolating those who might be, and really prevent another outbreak from happening. We are nowhere near the first part, which is, flattening the curve, and not even talking about how we might build up the infrastructure or the testing for the second part, which of course means we're very far away from being able to open up any, if not much, of the country.
And so you apply that view everywhere? I mean, I think there are certain parts of the country where people are looking and, you know, this is something they're seeing on the news, but they don't perceive it yet as something that's happening in their community. Are there, for example, rural school districts that could be open right now? Or are these measures where they're being applied, are they necessary essentially everywhere?
We don't know. I mean, that's the big problem is that, you know, part of the issue is you look at something like spring break in Florida, which just happened. All of those people potentially, you know, were mingling, getting infected, and then heading back to the rest of the country. In fact, I saw some graphic where somebody made where they tracked cell phones just to show where they were going. And it's horrifying because they were mingling just days, if not a week ago, and then all over, I mean, all over the East Coast, even into what we would consider, you know, Midwestern rural states. And so we don't know if there are infected people there. And so allowing them to go back to school, back to congregations, back to mingling could have significant ramifications for an outbreak developing there. And in those rural areas, it's important to remember, they don't have the same level of healthcare resources that are available in cities. So outbreaks there could be even more concerning, even at lower levels, because they could rapidly overwhelm whatever healthcare resources they might have.
Yeah, so Rich, I mean, you wrote this week about the unsustainability of the measures that we're doing right now, and you weren't arguing for, you know, just open things back up, but you were talking about the importance of getting to the place, I think, roughly, that Aaron is talking about eventually getting to. But it you know, it sounds from his description that, you know, we are quite some time away from being in the position where we do not have to sustain all of the measures that we're sustaining right now.
Yeah, I would say a couple things. One, with Trump's statement, even the initial version of it about Easter, it's clearly aspirational and had all sorts of exit ramps to it. Two, even if tomorrow he says, America, you're open for business, it's not going to have any meaning. And this is where I'd want to impress on my progressive friends the importance of federalism. President Trump doesn't run New York State. He doesn't run New York City. There's a governor and a mayor who do that, and they don't have to lift the lockdown no matter what President Trump says or does. And then three, there is a grassroots aspect to this, where even if Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio tomorrow said, guys, go back to work, no one would. No one's getting on the New York City subways at this moment. There's a real and legitimate fear out there. So I think some of the hysteria around what Trump said is unfounded. And I agree, though, with what Aaron says, or what I take to be part of what he's getting at, is the date is less important than what's the post-lockdown strategy. And this is concerning because we haven't heard it from the top. What does that look like? And there are clearly things that we can learn from overseas, obviously massive testing, which most people seem to think is going to be really important. Then also something I think that people haven't paid as much attention to, an enormous part of the Chinese response, once they stopped denying this and lying about it and punishing doctors for warning of it, was isolating the positive cases. So you go to a fever clinic, if you got a fever, they test you on the spot, they get the result really quickly. You don't go home waiting for the result or waiting days for the result, as some people are now. So you can infect the rest of your family, and households are a main vector for the spread of this virus. So what are we going to do to find the positive cases and isolate them? You know, that would be an alternative to eventually to the lockdowns we have now, but no one's really enunciating that vision or the practicalities around it yet.
Christine, I mean, what Rich describes there actually makes me feel a little bit despondent because, you know, if that is the key to what was done in China, it seems like something that I can't imagine you doing in the United States. I mean, are we going to have NYPD cops coming around New York and doing fever checks? And if you have a fever, they haul you off to the Javits Convention Center and you're not allowed to leave? Like, you know, I understand that people think this has been important in China, but it seems like something that would be so against the style of the American system that I can't imagine imposing a system like that.
Right. I completely agree with you there. I have many friends working in DC who are not American, who are foreigners who may be stuck in the city right now, actually, because they work for the World Bank or the IMF or some other organization that has kept them here. And this has been a great time for chain letters and misinformation. So every few days, I get a text from some fearful French person or Mauritanian who says, there's going to be a national lockdown coming in 24 hours, so make sure you get ready. And I reply back, that's definitely not going to happen here because Americans are too obsessed with their freedom and have too many guns for our government to make that actualizable in any real way. So I do think that that would be perhaps effective. But yes, I agree with you. I don't really see our government instituting it. If people were willing to make the individual sacrifice for the common good and isolate themselves, that would be a beautiful thing. And we're seeing some success with social distancing, but clearly also many people are not. But actually, to step back a little bit, I do want to agree with Rich on another point, actually. I also think that federalism is great in this moment because it has been allowing the governors, mayors, and other employees who seem much more competent in this period to go ahead and completely ignore our president's directives, which, as you mentioned, have ranged from the ridiculous to the dangerous. Opening everything back up and packing the churches full on Easter seems the obvious example. I mean, what better way to celebrate Christ's resurrection than to sentence many Americans to death? The lock it down versus reopen feels like a reflection of two different frames of mind. The idea of how do we lock it down seems like it shows concern for people. And how do we open things up as fast as possible seems more like a concern for the economy in the abstract. Obviously, there's overlap, but it's noticeable that the Trump administration seems rather excessively focused on the economy to the point of proposing so many policies that would be detrimental to the actual people of this country.
Aaron, when we talk about getting to that phase where we're using different strategies to control the epidemic and to stop outbreaks that happen, to what extent are we going to have to learn to do things that don't feel like things you'd normally do in the U.S.? And I don't just mean, you know, the question of, you know, do we need, you know, mandatory quarantines for people who are suspected positives like in China, although I don't know, maybe your view is that we do need that. But even when you look at what's being done in other countries that have had relative success, South Korea, Taiwan, they're not the sort of draconian measures that you've seen in mainland China, but it's still, you know, monitoring where people go on their cell phones and, you know, substantial fines for violating stay home orders and that sort of thing. It feels like it just feels very different from anything we've seen in the American system. So in addition to developing technological and logistical capabilities that we don't have right now, are people going to need to get used for some substantial period? You know, if we get a vaccine for this, it's you know, it's likely at least a year away. Are people going to need to get used to certain rules that they wouldn't have imagined themselves ever needing to follow as Americans?
Probably. I mean, some of them are going to be more palatable than others. I think we're going to have to be much more tolerant of, you know, someone placing a call to their employer and saying, hey, guess what? They just tracked me down and I was potentially exposed and I got to work from home for the next 2 weeks. And the employer goes, run, not, you know, that's going to be harder. How are we going to handle that? I think we're going to have to be much more tolerant of kids being held out of school or, you know, shutting down this or doing that on a small scale in order to avoid the big scale. But I do think that you're right. If we're going to get to where we can really manage outbreaks, we're going to have to be able to do sophisticated tracing and tracking down of people who were potentially exposed. And the quickest and easiest way to do that is by tracking people's cell phones, as we keep seeing in story after story in the media about how much data is actually there that many of us don't realize. There may be a need for public health to make use of that data. I understand the pros and cons of it. I get why people might be uncomfortable with it. Certainly, we'd want to have protections in place so none of that gets abused or misused. But we are going to need to be more comfortable with, you know, public health being able to track us down and get to us quickly using means that they might not have been able to before if we're really going to be able to be nimble enough to stay on top of outbreaks and prevent us getting to a point where we need to talk about flattening the curve and doing massive social distancing again.
Aaron Carroll is a professor of pediatrics and a researcher at Indiana University School of Medicine. Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We'll be back with economist Betsy Stevenson to talk about the rescue package and the unemployment outlook. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts. or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. On Friday, the House of Representatives reconvened to pass the $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill that had cleared the Senate earlier in the week. They'd hoped to do this by unanimous consent, with only a few people in the House chamber. But Congressman Thomas Massie, a libertarian-leaning Republican from Kentucky, threatened to block that maneuver. And so members of Congress returned to Washington angrily so they could vote in person. Massie has become something of a bipartisan punching bag. President Trump said he should be thrown out of the party, and former Secretary of State John Kerry tweeted that Massie had, quote, tested positive for being an asshole, unquote, and that Massie must be quarantined to prevent the spread of his massive stupidity. Trump then complimented Kerry on his sense of humor. Perhaps more importantly, Massie did not get sufficient support in the House to force a vote on the bill that was recorded, so it passed on a voice vote over his objections. As we taped, the president was expected to sign the bill late on Friday afternoon. The new law authorizes government payments of $1,200 to most adults. Those who lose their jobs will get much more generous and flexible unemployment insurance, adding up to thousands of dollars. There will be loans to small businesses that will get forgiven if those businesses keep their employees on the payroll. The Federal Reserve will get financing to provide trillions of dollars in loans to large companies to keep those companies afloat. States and hospitals will get cash infusions, and there is a special provision to pay airlines to keep their workers on the payroll, which is supported both by the airlines and by the unions that represent airline employees. To discuss what this package is likely to mean for Americans and for the American economy, Betsy Stevenson joins us now. Betsy is a professor at the University of Michigan. She was a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, and she served as the chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. Hello, Betsy.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
So is this a good package?
I think it's a good package. It provides much needed help for families. It provides much needed help for small businesses. It provides much needed help for the hospital sector. And then finally, for state and local government. So if I was going to point out the weakness of the bill, I think there's not quite enough help for state and local government. And I think that there's a real possibility we find out that this eye-popping $2 trillion is actually not enough.
Christine, this package has taken a lot of criticism from the left, basically, for being too generous toward big companies and not imposing enough restrictions on those companies' practices. There was talk that, you know, we want to make these companies pay a $15 minimum wage. We want to force them to put workers on their boards. That stuff's not in this package. But ultimately, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren both voted for it. So at least in the Congress, the left got comfortable with this.
Nancy Pelosi, Democrats on the left have noted that this is just the beginning of aid, that a major crisis is happening and that major help is needed, and this is the first and most urgent step. Democrats have stated, the left has stated, you know, that this is not the stimulus bill that they would have wanted necessarily, but in the moment when, you know, Americans are really screaming out for help, they can't really afford to sit back and tie everyone's hands and do nothing. There has to be some iteration and not sacrificing the good in favor of waiting for the perfect. That said, there are some, you know, clear downsides to this bill. I mean, for the many Americans who will continue to need to pay rent month after month without the jobs that they used to have, a one-time payment of $1,200 is not really going to keep them on their feet for that long. In a time of crisis where, yes, we could be putting forward big ideas and big worker protections, whether it's a higher minimum wage, you know, guaranteed sick leave while a literal health crisis is raging, it does seem like a shame that we're not able to pass those, but we're able to cushion corporations through this crisis.
Betsy, what do you make of that? I mean, obviously, in addition to the $1,200 payments, there's the significant expansion of unemployment insurance. What do you say to people who either say that this bill doesn't have enough on the individual side to cushion households that are trying to get through this, or who say that it ends up being a giveaway to large corporations?
So I think in the short run, there is just substantial help for households right now. The way they patched up the unemployment insurance system, which absolutely has way too many holes in it. And I will say that My hope is that when this is all over, we can have a real discussion about the safety net that America wants in place for something like this. But now's not a time for trying to build a permanent safety net. It's about trying to get money into the hands of people who need it. So they're using the unemployment insurance system to just send checks out to people regardless of how much they earned. If you qualify for unemployment insurance, you're going to get $600 a week on top of whatever your regular benefit is. And then you say, well, there's lots of people who don't qualify. They extended the qualification rules to capture a lot more people. They still knew that too many people were going to fall through the cracks. And so that's what those one-time payments are about. And then there are, you know, pretty strong incentives in there for corporations, for companies to keep paying their workers. So I think there's a lot in there. I have to say, I get a little frustrated by the critique that there's too much for businesses. You know, we saw people use the word bailout. You know, there's two things that we can do for businesses. We can give them money, gifts, grants, whatever word you want to use, and we can give them loans and help improve their liquidity situation. I think those are two very, very different things. When I look at what we did for the airlines, I feel annoyed at the grants. I'm not sure that I need to hold, you know, make sure that the airlines are held harmless by this, by giving them taxpayer money that they never need to pay back. Why did we do that? Well, we did that with the condition that they actually keep people on payroll. So we basically bribed airlines to keep paying people. So, you know, I understand why a lot of people thought that was the right thing to do. The loans, you know, that is good for all of us. We don't want a bunch of companies declaring bankruptcy. If they declare bankruptcy, we're going to have a mess to clean up when this whole thing is over. And we certainly do not want to see short-run liquidity problems turn into a solvency crisis in our, you know, in our financial markets. And so expanding, you know, supporting the Fed by capitalizing their lending facilities is absolutely the right thing to do. There's a lot of dysfunction in financial markets right now, and the Fed is working really hard to even that out. That dysfunction is coming from the extreme uncertainty we face right now. And so I think it is really important that we support companies through loans. And my hope is that it's going to be just like TARP, which we got a lot of criticism on the left for, but in reality, the TARP money was paid back.
Yeah, Rich, in addition to people on the left getting comfortable with things that they normally wouldn't feel like doing, people on the right, you know, Thomas Massie accepted, have also been getting comfortable with a lot of things that they would normally say they don't want to do. You know, the government bailing out companies that are in financial difficulty, the government sending out huge checks to people, running up, you know, an additional $2 trillion. So to Betsy's point, not all of that is going to end up being spending. Some of the money that's being used to capitalize the Fed's lending facilities, the government may make that back. But, you know, otherwise, this is well over $1 trillion in new spending. And you've seen near unanimity among conservatives that we need to do something of this scale.
Yeah, I mean, everyone recognizes the unusual and dire circumstances where large portions of the economy have just literally stopped. It has to be the most rapid economic downturn in American history, including the Great Depression and a lot of horrifying financial panics in the 19th century. I mean, this is economic activity disappearing not just within days, but in some cases within hours. So everyone realizes we need a patch. I think the appropriate name for this bill is not a stimulus bill. It's a relief bill. And as far as the aid for businesses, it's just businesses can't be expected to have enough assets and savings tucked away to weather a once-in-a-lifetime pathogen that no reasonable business person would have planned for. So you don't want them to die on the operating table. You want them to keep employing as many people as they can now and to go up to 100% capacity, hopefully as soon as possible once this thing passes. I'd have quibbles with how the individual checks were designed, but in the scheme of things, those are just quibbles. Would have much preferred that we had a more frugal government prior to this, so we just weren't adding to what was already a large deficit at a time of economic growth prior to the last 2 or 3 weeks. But again, you know, that can't be helped. And I would expect to be there to be more another bill after this that has a real big price tag too. And I don't know whether Larry Kudlow is right in his accounting of how much the total number is of liquidity and cash being pumped in the economy by Congress and by the Fed. You know, but he puts it about $6 trillion, which I'm sure is like a very round number, is roughly in the neighborhood. And that's, you know, the Fed and Congress doing that in the course of about 2 or 3 weeks. So that should alleviate a lot of suffering and be at least something of a bridge to get us through this period.
Betsy, can you talk a little bit about the logistics of doing such a large thing so quickly? I mean, we're leaning a lot on existing infrastructure. You know, we have unemployment insurance systems in every state. The checks they will be sending out will be bigger, but they have this capability to send money to people who have just lost their jobs. The Federal Reserve has certain lending programs that it's going to scale up. But some of this stuff, like the, you know, these hundreds of billions of dollars in loans to small businesses, what are the logistics of that going to look like? You appropriate the money. Are those where are those businesses going to go to get that money, and are they going to be able to do it in a timely manner? And then similarly with the checks to individuals, I've seen some people expressing worries that, you know, the IRS has direct deposit information for a lot of people because they paid tax refunds that way. And so a lot of people will get this money quickly in their bank accounts. But other people, they're going to have to jump through some hoops to actually get these checks. And I think people are wondering, you know, how long is it going to take to actually get that money out? And will some people who are entitled to the money never get it at all because of those logistical concerns?
Well, I think if you want to find the silver lining in the 2008 recession, it's that we are much better prepared today to be able to handle these kinds of challenges, because a lot of what we're doing is doing the kinds of things we did in that recession, but at lightning speed compared to what we did in 2008, 2009, 2010. So if you look at the Fed, you start there. I mean, they were whipping out the stuff they had done in the 2008 recession very early on, understanding exactly the kind of moves they needed to make. We have done, if you think about the, you know, the stimulus bill that they passed in 2008, I mean, that took forever to get done. Look at how fast Congress just moved. So I think, first of all, we just recognize that the pace at which everyone's been working here is incredible. As you just said, bringing people on the right to do things they never thought they would do, people on the left to do things they never thought they would do, and just everybody to unite and realize that we need help now. We've seen really fast movement. We've done checks before. We have a lot of information on folks. I think the hardest is going to be people who maybe didn't file returns or haven't been that engaged. There will definitely be some people who fall through the cracks. The hope is that most don't. I think, you know, you did put your finger on, I think, the place where people have the most questions, which is like, can the SBA actually support the number of small business loans that that they're trying to get out the door? My understanding is that, you know, we're going to hear sometime next week a little bit more guidance about how they can go about accessing those loans and how it's going to work. I mean, I can't, it's hard to know whether they're going to be able to handle the volume. I will say I was impressed and surprised that the unemployment insurance system could just handle the 3.3 million people who applied for unemployment insurance in 1 week. I mean, just stop and think about that. The previous weeks, they've been dealing with about 200,000 people a week, and then they processed 3.28 million claims. It's pretty incredible. There were decisions made in the bill recognizing that we needed that timeliness was more important than precision. A lot of people have said, why on earth didn't we just change the replacement rate on UI to 100%, and then people would just get whatever, you know, they'd been earning before? Why this fixed amount top up? I mean, it's a boring answer, but the reality is that asking, you know, every state agency to reprogram their computers to change the replacement rate, people thought would just take too much time. So when they thought about extending the safety net of UI, they came up with a plan that they thought, you know, you can't, there's no wage records. We can't have people submitting what they earned. So they came up with a plan that they thought would be able to be administered quickly. So I think that feasibility was on the top of everyone's mind when they wrote that bill. And so I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised to see how well it all works.
Yeah, Rich, what Betsy's alluding to there, this was one of the key disputes on the last day as the Senate was getting ready to pass this bill, was about the expansion of unemployment insurance, adding, in most cases, $600 on top of the weekly checks that people would otherwise be getting. And you had some Republican senators who pointed out, well, for a lot of people, that means their unemployment check will be bigger than the paycheck they were receiving for working. And so they're concerned that that's going to make people not want to work, which sounds like a churlish thing to worry about in this circumstance where we're throwing so many people out of work. We want people to stay at home and not work. But they're talking about, you have industries like grocers and healthcare institutions that need to retain their workforces right now. They were expressing this worry that basically people are going to choose not to work because the unemployment insurance checks were so large. And you know, I think Betsy lays out some of the logistical reasons why it had to be structured like that. I'm just wondering what you thought about Republicans fixating on that point during this process.
In normal circumstances, I would be totally on board that point. I think there's a case to be made. There's an argument about this, but the case to be made at the margins that the extension of unemployment benefits constantly after the financial panic at the margins may have made people create an incentive not to go back into the labor market. But this is just different. I mean, it's a temporary measure, 3-4 months, I guess, right? 4 months. And we've had massive numbers of people thrown out of work. So there's not really a question of the incentive structure one way or the other. So it's a great policy argument to have in normal circumstances. And I hope those circumstances return and we can have that robust argument as soon as possible, but it doesn't really apply in this crisis.
Christine, what did you make of that conversation?
Kind of exactly what you're saying. Churlish is perhaps one of the kinder words that I would have used. But I think that it actually gives us an opportunity to think a little bit about how we've structured our economy and the low-paying jobs that we offer people and expect them to be satisfied with. If Republicans and conservatives are so worried that an unemployment check that would allow people to sit alone at home is so attractive to people that it will force them out of work, maybe we should think about paying people more, perhaps a higher minimum wage that actually covers their life expenses. Probably more people would actually like to work, be productive, and also be able to take care of their families by, going in every day. Perhaps that should be the question, not seeing how we can starve them in this moment.
Betsy, you started off early in this conversation by mentioning that you didn't think there was enough in this bill for state and local governments. That's something that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has been saying very loudly, that he thinks that the New York State alone is going to lose $10 or $15 billion in revenue. There's going to be a need for significantly more federal aid to address that. And I think people are generally expecting this is not the last bill. So as you know, if Congress is going to come back into town in late April, what should they be looking at to figure out, what are the additional economic needs beyond what was addressed in this bill? How should they think about shaping the next bill?
Well, they do need to take a look at state and local governments because so many state governments face balanced budget amendments. What happens is as their revenue drops, they have to cut their spending. In 2008, it was the first recession in the history of the U.S. where we saw the cuts to government employees prolong the recession. We lost a lot of government jobs. And we don't want school systems come September to be laying teachers off. We don't want, state and local governments to be laying off workers right as we're trying to come out of this recession. So that would be something that would extend the recession as well as cause hardship. So they've got to take a real look at what the state and local governments need. I think that's going to be a first priority because that was really missing in this bill. There wasn't any sense of trying to help state and local governments make up for lost revenue. They were more focusing on the fact that state and local governments are going to have greater expenses because of the dealing with the crisis. And I think they're going to have to take a look at whether the funding for state and local governments to address the crisis has been enough. The other aspect, of course, is going to be dealing with households and making sure that, you know, we've given sufficient buffer to those households in making, you know, as has been pointed out, you know, the $1,200 was a one-time payment. Early on, it had been proposed that maybe we would make this a monthly payment. Of course, we have the president saying he's, you know, hoping we're all back at work in 2 or 3 weeks. So if that were the case, we wouldn't need it to be a monthly payment. Think more realistically when we listen to the advice of public health folks, we're probably not going to be back at work in 2 or 3 weeks. So we're going to need to think about, you know, what kind of additional help do families need?
Betsy Stevenson is an economics professor at the University of Michigan, a former member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, and former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. Thank you very much, Betsy.
Thank you.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
It's somewhat reassuring that some aspects of our national life are going on as normal, especially the oftentimes hysterical and irresponsible media coverage of President Trump. The latest is a spate of stories about a couple ingesting fish tank cleaner, supposedly because Donald Trump promoted chloroquine, which is in the cleaner, as a treatment for the coronavirus. Of course, the President of the United States can't be held accountable for every act of jaw-dropping idiocy in a country of more than 300 million people. That certain reputable media outlets suggested otherwise is one of the reasons that the media has the lowest approval rating of any institution in America during this crisis.
Christine Embo, what's your rant?
Look, I like a nice, productive, well-managed day as much as the next person. But in the middle of this crisis, I am 100% over being reminded of how productive I should be being. Yes, Isaac Newton formulated the theory of gravity and maybe invented calculus during the plague. And sure, Shakespeare wrote King Lear. Both of those men were geniuses. They also had housekeepers and no family to attend to during this time. Also, they weren't constantly being hounded and oppressed by an ever-multiplying set of Zoom meetings. And you, people online with your sourdough starters and your finished novels and your innovative art projects. A, feeding a bowl of fungus is unappetizing to me and I don't really want to hear about it. And B, not everyone has your blissful amount of free time. Look, I have a lot of stuff to do. I have a book I'm supposed to be writing. It's called Rethinking Sex. It's supposedly out next year. I have a job. I am lucky, I think, that I don't have to homeschool a passel of children in this time. But this is a moment in which we should be rethinking our obsession with productivity and the demands of capitalism. It would be productive and even healthy to embrace leisure and a quiet aloneness. It's the fact that companies wouldn't stop sending their workers to work and let them go home to socially distance that has, in fact, helped the virus spread. So stop telling me that I should be saving the world and supercharging my career right now. Let me just sit at home with my sweatpants and anxiety.
For my rant, this is a request from my friends in the media. Please stop trying to gin up a reality show style fight between President Trump and Dr. Anthony Fauci. Now, I realize it's an important news question whether the president is listening to the experts who are close to him when they have apparent disagreements on policy. That's important. But there's a tone of a lot of this coverage that's basically just sort of itching for this to break out into a fight where the president ends up firing Fauci. There was an article in the Washington Post this week about increasing critics on the far right who are attacking Anthony Fauci from outside the White House. I would note these are criticisms that are not coming from the president. One of the things that says in the article is, quote, Peter Barry Chowka, whose Twitter bio boasts that he's been retweeted by the president, recently referred to Fauci, who has advised multiple presidents of both parties, as, quote, a deep state Hillary Clinton loving stooge, unquote. Now, who is Peter Barry Chowka? That's an interesting question. They note that the president retweeted him twice in 2017. And that is somehow supposed to be indicative that this Twitter random is a person with an important opinion that gives an indication about how the president is working with Anthony Fauci. Now, look, I wish the president would listen more closely to some of the advice that he's been getting, but both Trump and Fauci have been sending public signals to indicate that they are continuing to work together despite sometimes having disagreements, and Fauci keeps saying that, you know, the president is listening to what they have to say. So it's not that there's nothing to worry about here, but there's sort of, it almost feels to me like some people want the president to fire Fauci so they can be proved right about the president being an irresponsible idiot. This is the last time that I want to be proved right about the president being an irresponsible idiot. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Christine Emba, Aaron Carroll, and Betsy Stevenson. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.